Love Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. I have no idea if anyone can hear me. The switchboard for Yada Yada Radio, in fact, for Blog Talk Radio, is completely berserk. I was able to log on initially and then set up the chat room, which we are able to participate in here. No other indication. I cannot see Kirk, who has called in, nor can I get JB to join us. And each time I have attempted to bring up the switchboard again, we're getting nothing. So, for those in the chat room, if you wouldn't mind, please text and let me know if you can hear what I'm saying. If you can't hear what I'm saying, then we'll just have to postpone to next week. Is anyone able to hear in the chat room? Well, folks, I think we're... this is not going to work this evening. We can't even get the Blog Talk Radio site to come up. Now, it may be a function of the storms they're having on the East Coast. We are here in the Southwest Ohio, north of Cincinnati. We're in the midst of an amazing blizzard. We've got winds blowing at probably 30 miles an hour. Snow's coming down sideways, started with ice and now snow. So it's just snow all night. I think the weather's even worse in the East Coast than it is here, so that could be the entire problem. Okay, I have one person that says they can hear. So I'm going to type in if anybody else can. If they can, then I'll continue and I'll start the program in Chapter 9 of Observations for Our Time. All right. Well, I'm going to begin. I'm going to look at the switchboard just to see if anyone else can hear. I'm sorry about the difficulties. We cannot get JB on. We cannot get Kirk on. We can't get the switchboard to work or anything with Blog Talk Radio to work other than the chat room seems to be working. Last week in the observations program, we concluded our analysis of Yahweh's initial discussion about the nature of Babel, the first time Babel comes up. And the reason that I want to turn back to this is that Babel is the one subject that never seems to go away. with Babel, we are constantly reminded right from the beginning that it is the source of religious, political, military corruption. It's the place where truth and lies are commingled for the specific purpose of confusing people. It is the basis of the name Bible in Christianity. It is it means with the Lord, Ba-bel. And as I'm now translating the 14th chapter of Yeshayah, what I have found is that the topic of Babel just continues to fester. It never goes away. As a matter of fact, by never, I mean that it, as life as we know it with Yahweh, nothing goes away. It is something that exists right to the time that Yahweh returns. And now in the 14th chapter of Yeshayah, as Satan, Hillel ben Shakar, brilliant son of darkness, is being described. And we learn an enormous amount about his character and the fact that he wants to be worshipped as God. We are told that Yahweh has to deal with everything associated with Babel right before his return. So, discussing it, understanding it, knowing what it means is really, it's absolutely essential to knowing what God is fighting, what the adversary is perpetrating, and what man is doing that has God so frustrated. This particular statement begins with Cush. Cush means black. He was a Noach's grandson by way of Cam. Cam means passionately idolatrous sun worshiper, which was a pretext of really everything associated with Babel. Fathered, Nimrod. Nimrod means rebellious son. Nimrod is actually the basis of the name of the city which became the capital of first Babylon and the later the capital of the Assyrian Empire, Nineveh. He was dishonorable and contemptible. Chalal. He was proud and profane, defiled and diseased, polluted and pierced, wounded and harmful. That description, while I'm certain it was apt of Nimrod, since none of us are ever going to deal with Nimrod, it is irrelevant, really, as it applies to Nimrod. It is only relevant as it applies to that which Nimrod represents. Now, that's not to say there wasn't a real Nimrod. In all likelihood, there was. But Nimrod here is not representative of an individual that lived nearly 5,000 years ago. But instead, Nimrod is representative of HaShatan, the adversary Satan. He is a stand-in for Satan. Satan was proud. He was profane. Profane means he was corrupted. He was defiled. He was diseased. That's why he's called the plague of death. He was polluted and pierced, wounded, and harmful. As a result of, and this is now the thing that caused Nimrod to be so disgusting, as a result of being a powerful political and heroic warrior. So he was a powerful politician and a heroic warrior. Now you can be those things and not be contemptible, not be dishonorable. Dode, for example, was those things. And he was not contemptible or dishonorable. I don't think there's been anyone else in all of human history, though, that was a powerful politician and a skillful warrior, a mighty leader, if you will, of men, other than Dode, who I think we're hearing.
I got the studio to come back up finally.
Okay, I'm still not able to get it, so we'll see if we can get Kirk in. But
I'm not seeing his number on the line, but I'll look for it.
Okay, all right. That is what made him so disgusting, and that should be a sober thought those who are political, those who are patriotic, of course, for those who are religious, is that God views powerful politicians and heroic warriors as dishonorable and contemptible. Now, as it relates to Satan, you may say, well, how would that apply to Satan? Those are the people that Satan influences. Satan almost never, and this is the thing that's just so weird about people, you know, you see a little child and they're, you know, the exorcist, they're demon-possessed. It doesn't do Satan any good to have one of his demons possess a little girl. Even if she does get to turn her neck all the way around and spew out guacamole.
We got cursed.
Satan, you know, Satan is only going to possess those who can influence lots of people.
Large numbers of people.
He's
right,
playing Satan a numbers game. Yahweh's
right.
Not about numbers, but Satan is.
That is correct. Exactly. That's one of the things that makes them opposites. And so the kind of people that Satan influences are powerful politicians and heroic warriors. Leaders of large organizations because he wants to corrupt the maximum number of people. And so you want to, you know, the people that society honors and that they bow down to and kiss their ring and all, those are the people that are the most influenced by Satan. So that's why this is stated, not only of this man, but how this man is a metaphor, a symbol of Satan. He would prominently and impetuously, powerfully and militantly. This is Gabor again. Now, I think we addressed this briefly in the evening program last week. By using Gabor here twice and speaking of a reprehensible individual, that completely shuts the door on the possibility that Gabor El was Almighty God in the prophecy in Yeshayah, Isaiah 9:6. You know, this idea that he's speaking of Yahusha and is calling him Almighty God with Gabor El, it's Gabor is used twice here. It's a term that Yahweh views as degrading, as contemptible, as dishonorable, as defiled, and it applies to a human. So, 9:6 cannot be a reference to Yahusha because it is a demeaning reference. Now, you know, you might say, well, then how could it be a reference to Dod? God's not going to demean Dod. Dod had lots of characteristics that were worth demeaning, that were worth criticizing. And, you know, the thing Dod wanted to do the most was build Yahweh's covenant house. And Yahweh said, no, you know, you're not worth much of your life. Yeah, you spent too much of your life as a man of war. Too much blood on your hands. My house is not going to be stained by that. So he would prominently and impetuously, powerfully and militantly hunt his prey in direct opposition to Yahweh. Hunting is not something that God views favorably. He doesn't look at killing or viciousness as a favorable thing. Now, that is not to say that hunting for food God would view negatively. He doesn't. I mean, he obviously created the likes of lions, tigers, and bears. You know, they hunt for food. You know, he created wolves and foxes. They hunt for food. Even birds of prey, they hunt for food. I mean, so hunting for food, fine thing to do. If you're going to kill the animal, kill it in the most, you know, merciful way possible. And eat it. You know, don't as so many do, kill for sport so you can hang a head on a wall.
Yeah, you talk to any deer hunter, you know, they'll tell you the best way to take down deer and the best way, you know, you get the best flavor from the meat is you take it down with a single shot.
Yeah, right.
That's your goal. You want it to drop right there, die quick and easily.
Right through the heart.
You don't want to cause it suffering. And then you take it, you clean it, and you use almost every bit of meat and skin from that animal.
Right.
There's a big difference between that and the guys going over to Africa to kill an elephant so they can mount it on their wall, and none of that food's going to get eaten. They have no use for any of it.
Or an elk or a bison or any of it. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Kill the food, go for it.
Nimrod and Satan hunt prey for fun. Kill. They make a game of killing in direct opposition to Yahweh. Therefore, it is said, the likes of Nimrod, prominently and impetuously, powerfully and militantly, third time of Gabor. Boy, we are learning that Gabor is definitely not a term that can be used in conjunction with God unless you're dealing with Dod. Dod was the mighty politician and the triumphant warrior on behalf of God. The only one. Stalk, capture, control, victimize, prey, pursuing the life of others to destroy it. Sayed acts as a hunter pursuing game by killing animals. It's to stalk and victimize, capture and control, ensnare and kill. Against, oh boy, you should see my page now with runtime errors and everything else for on the switchboard for Blog Talk Radio. Yeah. It looks like the switchboard just got chicken pox. Nimrod.
I found that up when I opened it in Edge instead of Chrome, it worked just fine.
Oh, really?
I don't know why, but yeah. I don't know why, but that worked for me, so at least it got it up.
Wow. Well, that is a strange phenomenon.
Probably an update to their code that isn't compatible with Chrome yet.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, I usually open it in Chrome, and it's definitely not working in Chrome. And it normally
That's my go-to also.
Yeah. So, he was unique among men in that he was a politician who made a game of victimizing his prey. And we mentioned this in one of the two shows, and I've forgotten which one. It's just the idea that if you are king, which Nimrod was, you don't hunt unless for food. Unless you only hunt it unless you find it fun. Killing for you is fun. And that was the nature of Nimrod, just for Satan. Killing is fun. So you look at Satan's most overt religion, it's Islam. You know, what's the signature act of Islam? Killing.
Yeah.
Always has been. So this came to be the beginning of his kingdom of Babel, of Babylon, of confusing corruption. It either means gate of God or gate of the Lord. I mean, you know, if you read any one of the lexicons, they'll tell you that Babel means in the Akkadian language, gate of God. But it's Babel. And Bel was the primary name of the Babylonian God. So why don't we make it of the Lord God as opposed to just God, because we know what the words mean. And, of course, Babel means to confuse by mixing together, to corrupt by commingling. If you look at the most popular religions today, Christianity. Christianity is the epitome of Babel. With Christianity, they have mixed together truth and lies. They have taken bits and pieces of what God has revealed and then combined it with particularly with Babylonian religious lies to create the religion of Christianity. It is confusing and corrupting because of its commingling. And the reason that Christianity is a commingled religion is because if they did mix in some truth with the lies, those lies wouldn't be credible. And if you were to tell people that God died for them, well, that's not credible. So you better mix in a whole bunch of lies along with it.
You mean truth?
Truth along with it, because you are never going to convince any rational person that God died. You know, this idea that that there was a bodily resurrection is so stupid that you better mix in some stories along with it, or no one's going to believe you. A God named Jesus 1600 years before the J was even invented. I mean, come on, folks. That the two big holidays.
Kind of like, look what happened with Muhammad before he started, you know, in Mecca, before he moved to Yathrib and was able to get credibility from stealing Talmud stories, he was a complete and utter failure. Everyone laughed him out of town because he was so ridiculous.
Yeah, when he was plagiarizing lies, so mixing his lies with the lies of the Hanath, the Yemenites, who were worshiping Ar-Rahman, the Merciful, he was laughed out of town. It was only when he began to mix his lies with some elements of truth that came out of the Talmud that the Quran took on a veneer of credibility. Yeah, he's the perfect example. You know, Islam mixes Christianity, Judaism, and the pagan past of the Arabs all together. It confuses by intermixing. So that is the nature of confusion. It's the nature of religion. And even, you know, you look at Judaism. Judaism is a mixing together. It's the Talmud runs arguments against the Torah.
And mixing rabbinical argument with Torah to give the rabbinical argument justification.
Right.
Make it confusing enough so no one understands it, and then they have to listen to us to tell them what it means.
Correct. So this came to be the beginning of his kingdom of Babel. Of confusing corruption, including Erech, which means prolonged self-reliance, Akkad, which means subtle, deceitful, and treacherous deceptions. Boy, is that the nature of commingling. And Kelneh, ignominious, shameful, and lowly. Well, I know somebody that is has the name of lowly. Polos, in the land of Shinar. Shinar is Sumer, means between the two rivers. Now, the reason that this is particularly important is that since there's so many references to Babylon, since Hasatan is both called the ruler of Babylon and also the ruler of Assyria, is that by including these other places along with Babel and having Nimrod associated with Babel, we now have a cohesive whole. When Yahweh is speaking of Babylon, Assyria, or of Ur, or of Chaldeans, it's all the same place, it's all the same people. That's why I should not have been surprised that before Hasatan was associated with Babel in the 14th chapter of Yeshayah, that he was called the Assyrian in two chapters prior. These things, from God's perspective, are all the same. From that territory, he went out. And what is the first place he went out to? Asher. Asher is Assyria, named in honor of Assyria, the great lord of the Assyrian pantheon. It, of course, means gracious. It's like in Islam, Ar-Rahman is one of the attributes now ascribed to Allah.
Merciful.
It means graceful, gracious and merciful, but also a warrior and terrorist. Hey, he's a merciful terrorist. He'll cut your throat off with, you know, with maybe three slits and not 25. He'll use a sharp knife when he decapitates you. He's a loving and merciful terrorist.
You know, by technical definition of mercy, that would be showing someone mercy. Mm-hmm. Mercy's not necessarily a good thing.
Yeah, that's correct.
Just because someone's merciful, I mean, they're being good. You can be bad and merciful.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, if you're torturing somebody, you're being merciful if you put them out of their misery.
Exactly.
So from that territory,
so when you're a good person.
Yeah, to Asher. And he built Nineveh is based on the same basis of Nimrod. Nin means sun in the Akkadian dialect. And Nineveh is Nineveh. Refuge of the fleeing sun, the rebellious sun, Nimrod. Rapable, which means the open way and the broad path. We've heard that before, you know, that the way to death is open and broad. And Kelah, which means to finish, to perish, unable to prevail, even though physically strong. And that's what's going to happen to Hasatan. He is physically strong, but nonetheless, he's going to perish. So just that quick description of where these places are, what these places represent, why God despises them, what Nimrod has in in association, in comparison to Hasatan, and how Asher, Babylonia, Babel, Nineveh, Ur of Suma, all of these things are related from God's point of view. So this is the second time we're going to hear about Babel, and it really is quite interesting. This is the story of which is now just thought to be a curiosity as the Tower of Babel. But there's a lot to this that we can learn a great deal, and the more we know about Babel, the easier it will be for us to understand the story that's being presented in Yeshaya Isaiah. In fact, if you don't understand what God has to say about Babel, I don't think you could understand the revelation to Yahuconah. I mean, the last third of the book is devoted almost entirely to Babylon. The huge part of Daniel that's devoted to Babylon. So Babylon is a big deal. A bad deal, but a big deal. Yeah, so now it came to this. Time and time again. It's the thing that God hates the most. He has very little to say about outright lies, because outright lies don't fool many people. He has a lot to say.
They fool idiots, and Yahweh doesn't have an interest in idiots.
Correct.
Hello?
Hello, Kirk. You're with us.
Oh, yes. I'm just checking in. I've been going back and forth.
We're having a really good time with Blog Talk Radio. They're on their game today.
Yes.
So now it came to pass with ongoing consequences that the entire region had one language. And so the words were closely related, sharing common characteristics. Now you might think, well, that would be a really wonderful thing. And if you look at Akkadian, which would have been the language of Babylon, Akkadian and Hebrew are really close. Kirk, have you had the opportunity or HAB to translate the small sections, any parts of the small sections of Daniel that are in Aramaic?
No.
Okay.
I've got a verse or two here or there, but that's about it, not a lot.
Okay. You don't have to do much. And what you find is that the commonality of the words is significant. And you know, Yahweh may use Q-U-W-M or Q-U-W-B to say stand, and it may be K-U in Aramaic.
That's what I know. It's more like a dialect of Hebrew than it is a separate language.
Correct.
It's like, talking to someone in Louisiana, that Cajun kind of dialect versus Southern dialect, or a Boston dialect versus a Texas dialect. Yeah, it's the same language. We're just saying the words a little bit differently.
Yeah. An S versus a C, a Q versus a K, that sort of thing is really the only
difference. Yeah, they're making the same sound by and large, but
correct.
Just slight differences.
Right. So the Hebrew and Aramaic were a very similar language. And you might say, well, why would God want to confuse it? Wouldn't it be great if we all spoke Hebrew? Wouldn't that just be great? We would have all these challenges trying to translate this. And I'm telling you that if we all spoke Hebrew, the corruptions, the twisting, the malfeasance would be so much greater than it is now. The very fact
how many people that speak Hebrew do you know that are fluent in Hebrew actually are part of the covenant? And look at how many people who weren't part of the covenant.
Not one.
All of the Jews in the world speak, not all, but majority of them speak Hebrew almost fluently, but they were still able to be beguiled by it because they controlled and manipulated the language over time.
Correct. Yeah, in fact, if the evolution of Hebrew was specifically based on the Shoah system, and that Shoah system was the rabbinic system of the Masoretes, designed to specifically mislead. In fact, Shoah means to mislead. So there are some advantages of not being fluent in Hebrew, so that you have to look up the meaning of every word, and you're not easily fooled, and it takes real effort. And if you're going to spend that much time, the last thing you want to do is to have your time not be rewarded. So there are real problems with people all speaking the same language. And the other thing it does is it makes it much easier for people to control others. I can't have much influence over a Scandahoobian because I don't speak Scandahoobian. You know, it's my influence in Mexico is about as far-reaching as my my prowess in Spanish. You know, se habla español. You know, there is a real reason why God recognized that we were going to do less damage to ourselves if we all didn't speak the same language.
Well, we have an example of it, and it turned into a flood.
Yeah.
So obviously, it wasn't a good plan.
Yeah.
Our nostalgia is too sharp to. If you want to manipulate, you manipulate. So.
Correct. Correct. And well, ultimately,
there's something to be said for making it too easy. You make it a challenge, and then you get the people you want to spend time with. You know, you want the people who are willing to invest the time. You don't want the people that want the easy route. But what fun are they going to be in eternity?
I would be willing to voice this as a thought. Over the last 50 years, the elite of the world have come to almost universally speak the same language.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. English.
Yes.
There are very few world leaders of consequence who don't speak English.
You know,
we
British.
Are in a...
Excuse me, go ahead.
Yeah, the British had a huge influence.
Well, they had a whole plan with what's his name down in South Africa. His was to the scholarships where you go back to Cambridge. But the whole point was to get them to be Britishized and English speaking. You know, all of them got scholarships to go back. They took the finest of every country so that they could all become good Englishmen, so they could control them. They felt they
right.
couldn't do it with an army forever. They knew that.
Right.
So that was only Rhodes scholarships is what I was trying to say.
So then it came to pass as they migrated towards the east from where they had previously existed long ago, while moving in the direction of the rising sun, they discovered a valley in the region of Shinar, Sumer, which became Babylonia and Mesopotamia between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and they settled there. So it's interesting, by the way, that I would dare say that 50 to 75 years ago, maybe 100 years ago, there weren't 20 people on the planet that knew there was a place named Sumer. In fact, I would be willing to tell you right now that if you were to ask 1,000 people, what can you tell me about Sumer? That they, you know, it's a
place
Sumer,
mentioned in the Bible.
I don't think so. By the way, they
I think that'd be the best you would get.
Hmm. Yeah, I think if you were to say you would get 5 out of 1,000 people to say, of the Chaldeans. Yeah, that's where
Abram came from.
Yeah, but I don't think you would get even 1 out of 1,000 people on average, just individuals, to know anything about Sumer. Did you know anything about Sumer until you just became totally fascinated with archaeology and ancient history, Kirk?
I thought so. I can't remember that. It wasn't unfamiliar to me when you know when we started talking about it. But that doesn't mean I knew a lot about it.
I don't think most people know much about it. It's kind of like the Hittites. You know, if you were to go back 75 years. The Hittites were a civilization that were used to say that the Bible is fictitious. It's all myth.
Yeah,
these people never existed. Yeah,
right,
and of course now they found out that it was one of the most powerful civilizations in ancient history, and they're chronicled by the Babylonians, by the Assyrians, and by the Egyptians, as well as the Phoenicians and Carthaginians speak of them.
Yeah.
Well, Sumer is sort of a similar thing. In fact, it reminds me a little bit of Ramses.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to the less than 100 years ago now, and the Rosetta Stone, no one could read, therefore pronounce, any of the hieroglyphics in in Egypt, there was no way to know that the god's name was Ra, or that the pharaoh's name was Ramses. And yet, if you read in the Torah, Ramses is right there, pronounced correctly, written correctly, transliterated correctly. The same thing is true here with the Shinar. It's a description of a place and a people that was correctly depicted thousands of years before history remembered the place. Matter of fact, even the digging up and trying to locate ancient Babylon was because an Egyptian archaeologist in 1899 thought, hey, you know, I'm reading about these stories of a place called Babylon. I want to look for it. So it's, you know, prophecy in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms is all of time. You know, to be Yahweh's witness proves itself through its past, not just from its future proclamations.
Why is it, if I may ask, why is it that no one ever complains that they get all the bad guys and the bad places' names correctly, and they twist all the transliterations of all the good guys?
Yeah, we certainly don't have any problem with...
I know who Nebuchadnezzar is, but...
There's only one name. Only one name.
Nimrod?
There's only one... Yeah, Nimrod's another one. I think there's only one name that I'm aware of that is a bad guy that they just butchered. And that is Hillel ben Shakar.
Yeah.
And they butchered it to Lucifer. It doesn't mean Lucifer.
No.
You know, Hillel means, is from halal. It means to radiate light. Shining one. And Shakar is either darkness or rising sun, for example. And it's ben Shakar. Shakar also means of the east.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he is the arrogant one, because Hillel also means prideful and arrogant. The arrogant one of the east. What was east? Babylon. The description of where Hillel ben Shakar came from. So he is of the east. And it's I love the juxtaposition, because Satanism is a being of light. So it's the shining sun of darkness, because Shakar also means darkness. So it came to pass as they migrated toward the east from where they had previously lived long ago, moving in the direction of the rising sun, they discovered a valley in the region of Shinar, of Sumer. And they said, each individual to his immoral countrymen, so one of those great raw words, Kirk, his loud mouth and evil public speakers with troubling social, racial, and religious pontifications. Come, I implore you to act, choosing to do what I want done, because I want you to allow me to control you, all while you ascribe excellence and greatness to me. I want us to make an expression of my will using sun-dried and whitewashed bricks and writing tablets. Then I want you to burn an offering to the fiery serpent so as to approach the place of the serpent's place. It was interesting, I'm translating now Yahshua 14, the end of it. And one of the last things that Yahweh wipes out is the fiery serpent. In fact, he uses four different words for serpent, and the last one is this one, this fiery serpent. It's a supernatural winged beast that radiates light. And so that's who the Babylonians were building these monuments to. The fiery serpent. We're dealing with Hasatan. And they're doing it because that's what they want. You know, almost every verb here had two expressions of volition, not just one. This is what I want, but I want you to want what I want. Let's do this because this is what we want to do. Let's build this great monument to the fiery serpent. And so the whitewashed bricks and the sun-dried mud writing tablets came to actually and continually be for them as stone. It became rigid, dense, hard. You know, that which they were never able to destroy. Rigid and hard. And the tar, the sticky slime, the troublesome combustible black hydrocarbon, which could be used as an adhesive to bind, as vicious tar to trap, as a seal to waterproof, and as asphalt to pave over, even fuel to burn. For a while, came to genuinely exist for them as an intoxicating and slimy binding agent akin to a particularly or partially fermented intoxicant, which enrage and torment. So, you know, most English Bibles, you're just going to say they had tablets and tar, or stones and tar, and that's how they built these things. Well, what does tar represent? Well, it's troublesome, combustible, it's an adhesive that binds, it's vicious, and therefore it entraps. It's waterproof, and you can't cleanse what's under it. Go ahead.
No, so is that where we got the idea of the tar baby in folklore?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the tar baby.
Yeah. Of course, you saw what happens to the dinosaurs in Los Angeles when they got in.
Yeah, with the La Brea tar pits.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's tar. It's sticky. It's slimy. It's troublesome. And those tablets, they're writing tablets, and they're specifically adept for being written over to whitewash something underneath them. And they said, expressing in words, vowing, we want to control you so that you praise what we choose to worship. Let us continually build for ourselves a city with an inner shrine and temple complex, and then a highly valued platform and imposing tower for religious worship with its top in the spiritual realm of the heavens. Church steeples. And let's engage, actually creating for ourselves a name and reputation, or otherwise, will be attacked, scattered, and dispersed over the face of the entire region. Boy, you think about that, the steeple to the sky, and the first thing that comes to my mind is that Egyptian obelisk in the middle of the Vatican. They have another one by the Papal Palace. You know, how in the world can you expect a billion people to be so stupid that you've got a pagan Egyptian religious artifact in the middle of the place you call your holiest capital, and no one will even bring it up and say, you know, that's really wrong. What the hell do you think you're doing?
Well, I think P.T. Barnum put it right. There's a sucker born every day. They're betting on that.
Well, there's obviously 1.5 billion of them. That's how many Catholics there are today.
It's definitely the majority.
Yeah, a valued platform and an imposing tower for religious worship. At its top.
Well, what's funny is it's not even just Catholics that venerate it. I know so many non-Catholics who still hold a lot of respect for the Pope and the Vatican and all of that. Yeah, they may not follow it. They may not be Catholics, but it's still, yeah, they still consider him a very spiritual person and someone to look
up. A holy man. Yeah, important religious leader.
A man of God.
A voice, a voice of morality. Yeah, he's a piece of crap. Is what he
morality.
Yeah, is exactly what he is.
That's your definition of morality. I want nothing to do with you.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, by the way, they talk about building these cities. In Isaiah 14, one of God's grievances, one of the reasons that God says I had to intervene, was that man was about ready to build cities everywhere. He says, you know, the whole planet's being covered with cities. Enough of it already. You know, too much of it. I don't like these cities. You know, God's idea of camping out is what he did with Adam in the garden. God is not interested in building these massive urban hubs and cities. And it says right there at the end that one of the things that his grievances with mankind is our propensity to build cities, and they were building cities everywhere, and it was just, God was sick of it. Yahweh descended for the purpose of observing the city and temple complex and its imposing tower for religious worship, all designed to increase their importance, their influence, and their authority, which is to establish their way, and the sons of the descendants of Adam had built. And that's really the whole purpose of building large cathedrals, of building large mosques, is it gives people power and control over others. You know, these giant edifices are to God, and, you know, and they wouldn't exist unless God was real, unless we were building these for Him, and you know, it gives a veneer of authority and credibility. That's why they build them. It's the easiest way to impose your influence.
To what you just read there, though. God descended to observe. How can why would an omnipresent God need to descend so He can observe it? Blows out our water right there.
Because God's not omnipresent nor omniscient.
Exactly.
Omnipotent.
Neither. And
blows your religious God right out of the water.
All right. If God were omnipresent or omniscient, He would cease to be interesting. He would cease to be unique. He wouldn't be worth knowing. Couldn't be known, as a matter of fact.
Well, and we wouldn't be worth knowing to Him.
That is correct.
He would gain nothing out of a relationship with us.
He wouldn't need a relationship. He'd know everything there is to know.
Know everything there is to know.
Right. What's the fun of a relationship where you know everything that's going to happen over the next 10 years of that relationship, 100 years of that relationship? You know everything that's going to happen. What's the fun of that relationship?
Yeah. You know, it is possible for God as light to know everything that will happen with everyone. He just chooses not to, because it would spoil all of the enjoyment of the relationship. He has paid enough attention to the broad strokes at a distance to tell us where the world is going and how we're going to come to an end in all of this. In terms of individuals, you know, He does not know what any one of the three of us are going to do tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's not in His. It's counter to His interest to know that. Then Yahweh declared and explained, "Pay attention. Behold, something important is being emphasized. Be observant now. Look up, listening carefully to the insights being conveyed. Notice the details in this narrative, considering the context, because, well, surely, this can change your perspective. One race, one nation and people, with one way of speaking for all of them, considering what they have done, is then contemptible, reprehensible, and deadly for them, undermining life while lowering their status by breaking, debasing, and dissolving the promise." One world government, not something that Yahweh looks on favorably, in fact, extraordinarily negatively. This idea of everybody speaking the same language and all communicating happily together, really, Joe, listen to one another. No. These ideas are in direct opposition to God. We ought to listen to Yahweh. We ought not be listening to one another. We ought not have any government, much less a one-world government. The larger the government, the worse it is. And the ultimate is a one-world government. And so then, they will not be restrained from putting into effect and carrying out anything which they wickedly decide and propose. They collectively plot and plan with their evil intent by agreeing together. If everybody is speaking the same language, if there's one world government, man is going to do things that are horrendous, and there's really no restraint. That's why in the last days there's a nuclear holocaust.
Having read 20 today, boy, what is, and I've got the old form because we haven't been able to, we had some printer problems with the new printer, and Bank printed the new version, but my gosh, that is... You start out hurting for Yahweh, and at the end, you almost want to just wipe them out. I mean, I like your three parts where you said, "Look, here's the deal. We got three people left on the planet." I don't mean to interrupt too much, but three people on the planet, and you said, "Okay, we have the people who are the perpetuators of all this, the one God's really going to get, and obviously Sheol is waiting for them. Then you've got the others who are just supportive of them." And they're just wasted. There's nothing you can do to save those people. There's no reason to save them. I mean, they're just a waste.
They are a waste.
They're just total. So it's not cruel. is the only way to get the planet going back in the direction he wanted it to begin with, because they will only just, they'll fall for the same stuff again. I mean, or they will never turn around. And then you have a little minute group of people that like Yahweh and will listen to him and observe him.
There's so few a child could count them.
Yeah. And it's just so everything is absolutely, it's easy to see now. I mean, it's harder before. You start out saying, my, you know, a few weeks ago I was even thinking, my God, it's 99.9% of the planet, I mean, of the people on the Earth.
Yeah.
I don't know how you get around any other thing. It can't happen any other way and be fair.
Yeah. I mean, I would tell you that one of the things that has become a challenge for me is, you know, I'm within now 2 verses of finishing Yeshayah 14. And Yeshayah 14 is really profound. But, oh my, it's gotten to be, it's so dark.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just,
it's so bad. We don't even know why to shoot a squirrel, you know, and
it's so dark.
Horrible stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
our future is bleak. Humankind's future. Yeah. We are really terrible. And
we're looking at 10 years, and it's where it begins.
Right. God is just going to wipe them all out. Billions of people.
Yeah.
Going to exterminate them.
And he wanted to save a lot of these people. He wanted them to be part of his family. That was the Terry part. You know.
Yeah.
They've taken these people. They're being punished for taking these people away that he wanted in his family.
Correct. Yeah, and that's but the thing that was stated so eloquently by JB early on is that.
Yeah.
Yahweh has never been all that interested in numbers. You know, one person was enough for him in a relationship. But Satan is a numbers guy. That's why Satan really only goes after world leaders, political, religious, military leaders, and possesses them and influences them because they, in turn, reach so many people.
That's why Paul was kind of his biggest win ever. It kind of gave him a foothold in Scripture. You know, to use that word, yeah. Within Yahweh, he got his words written up in the same book as Yahweh's.
Right. Correct.
Yeah.
That's the biggest win he ever had, probably.
Yeah. No,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yep. That's what gave absolute credibility. And so, then they will not be restrained. Putting into effect and carrying out anything which they wickedly decide and propose. Collectively plot and plan evil, intent by agreeing together. Come now, I implore you, by your own free will, because I want you to pay attention to me and then to act. You know, when you first read these, you say, you know, who is Yahweh talking to? Who is he imploring? Because, you know, the Moloch up there in heaven, they don't have free will.
No.
So, come now, I implore you of your own free will, because I want you to pay attention to me and then to act, choosing to do what I want done. Who is God talking about here?
Chosen.
Who is he talking to?
Chosen.
I think he's talking to us.
Well, that's...
I think he's telling you, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do here and why I'm going to do it. I want you to pay attention. I want this to be something that you choose to understand, and that you'll follow my lead. You'll act as I am acting. You'll understand why it's important to do what I'm going to do. So choosing what I want done of your own volition. Now, I'd like you to respect me, he says. Choosing to communicate your response, ascribing value to what I'm offering. Because why? Because the vast preponderance of people are worshiping the devil.
Mm-hmm.
So I want you to respect me. I want you to communicate your response, ascribing value to what I'm offering, so that you allow me to influence you. Let's choose to go down, even for us, to criticize Islam, for example. We have to go down to do it. We're on a much higher plane than they are. We have to go down to do it. Choose to go down temporarily to grading an aspect of ourselves. Every day, you know, that writing the prophet of doom or questioning Paul, you needed a shower. I mean, it was degrading. But it was important to do because we want to confound and compromise through commingling their ability to communicate. So they will not listen to the individual speech and rhetoric of their immoral countrymen, their loudmouthed and evil public speakers, with their troubling social, racial, and religious pontifications, which are improper and harmful. Now, what I think Yao is telling us is that he wants us to expose the commingling that they have been part of. And he wants us to also be, for us to be opposed to commingling ourselves. There is this natural tendency when you put anything online, that's the whole nature of like Facebook and social media, people write things, they want to be liked, they want it, and a tweet, they want to be retweeted. I would say, don't join. Don't yourself mingle with these negative things and expose why what they're doing is wrong. And it's hard to do. It takes time because, as I say, Christianity isn't completely wrong. It's mostly wrong. So there's elements of truth that run through the lies to make the lies more believable.
Yeah.
And so I think God is imploring us to, A, not be involved in intermixing truth and lies. Don't form alliances with people who are wrong just because it will make what you're saying more popular. Don't do that. Don't expose the lies.
Mm-hmm.
So Yahweh dispersed and separated them from there and from that name throughout the entire region. And they ceased what they were doing and refusing and rejecting the process of building and establishing the city with an inner shrine and temple complex. Therefore, as a result, he called and designated it by its name, excuse me, therefore denoting her reputation as Babel, as confusion and corruption, as Babylon. Because there, Yahweh commingled and mixed together, thereby confused and confounded, compromising the rhetoric of the entire region. So that is God's message to us, is this is what Babel represents. It means to commingle and mix together. You know, the New Testament, in essence, annuls the Old Testament. And yet, it's in the same book.
Yeah.
Well, and at the same time, it tries to draw its credibility from it.
Right.
Its only credibility comes from that.
Why it annuls it.
So
why
you annul your only source of credibility you have.
Correct. You know, a rational person would say, oh, come on. That's so stupid, it hurts. I mean the whole concept of Paul contradicting God and yet claiming to speak for him is stupid to the point that it is, you have to be irrational to believe it.
Or ignorant, and that's the thing, is most Christians never read the Old Testament. They'll read a verse here or there when their pastor tells them to or tells them that this points to that, but most of them don't. They're 100% New Testament centric. I still remember back when I was an atheist, I decided to sit down one time and I was going to read through the Bible. And I started reading through Genesis and going through an English translation. A lot of it doesn't make sense. And I was asking questions to my religious friends. They're like, well, what about it? And you whipped out doubt every time, everyone. Four or five different people. I'll go, oh, well, don't bother with that. Just start here. And they flip it straight to the New Testament. Like, this is what you really need to read.
Yeah, and by the way, they don't want you to read
me to start? Yeah, I'm a rational person. I'm not starting a book two-thirds of the way through.
Oh, yeah, there's 7, 8. And, of course, they don't want you to read Matthew because Matthew says, you know, don't think that I came to annul any of this. Wait a minute, you just told me to skip it. But no, I didn't come to do away with it. Well, but you just told me to skip it. Wait a minute, that's going to exist so long as the heavens and earth exist? Wait a minute, you told me to skip it.
There's a reason I was an atheist or agnostic for so long was religion made no sense. And when I'm trying to read your Bible and this is supposed to be where the basis of it, and you're telling me to skip half of it, I'm going, you're an idiot. That makes your religion an idiot. I'm not having anything to do with it.
Yes. Yeah. Why do you have the genealogy in Matthew if the part that came before it is irrelevant?
Yeah.
Why is he obviously Jewish and Christianity is anti-Semitic? Right. Well, explain this to me.
Yeah. Let me show you. This week I was flipping through the channels and Jimmy Swaggart came on. And I normally would just keep on flipping, but he was in the middle of a sermon and he was talking about, his topic was the Old Testament. I don't want mentioned a church. And I said, wait a minute, hold on.
The New Testament.
Well, he goes on, he says, not, no prophet, not, nor anyone from Abraham through Joseph, so much as hinted of a church.
Right.
And he went on and listed more of the prophets and so forth. And I'm going, wow, Yashiyah, he mentions too. He calls him Isaiah, of course. And I'm going, well, let's see where he's going to go with this one. And then the reason he gave, he said, was, and I have to paraphrase a little bit because I didn't really take notes. I just, I've heard this story before. So he reasoned that the reason he gave was God being omnipotent and omnipresent had foreknowledge that the Jews would reject him, Jesus, and the Lord, Christ, the Messiah, and crucify him on the cross. So I'm going, okay. And then Jesus
crap. The Jews didn't crucify him, you idiot. The Roman Catholics did.
I know. I was trying to do this today, this afternoon. I was going to go through this and let you go off on this. Because I know what you would say, and I knew what I would say. And you're absolutely right.
By the way, if he had the foreknowledge that they were going to reject him, how was that foreknowledge when every one of the prophets spoke of, you know, way back in 700 BCE of the fact that they had rejected him? How was it foreknowledge of the prophets that they were going to reject him when every single one of the prophets speaks of them already having rejected him?
Mm-hmm.
You piece of crap, pastor. Or, and then, by the way, since he has foreknowledge, why in the hell would he say, well, I better turn to Gentiles when everything he says about Gentiles is horrific?
Absurd.
Why would he turn to Gentiles because of his foreknowledge when in every one of his prophets he says, I'm going to reconcile my relationship with Israel and with Yehudah? If there was a goddamn church going to come up here, why in the hell did he say, I want to reconcile my relationship with the church? He doesn't.
Yeah.
It's always with Yisrael and Yehudah. You have to be a lying, scheming piece of crap to say what Swaggart had to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, here was his answer.
There's a reason I hate these people.
I was going to bring it up because it ought to be said, because it's the same story, certainly from a Pentecostal group, and which are huge. And he said that Jesus Christ asked his disciples, you know, he said, who do you say I am? He went to that verse. And, of course, this is Elijah and John the Baptist and all. And then Simon Peter, or Shimon Kedesh, declared, you're the Christ and the Messiah, which is not what he said. And Jesus said, no man gave you this, so on this rock I'm going to build my church, my ecclesia.
Yeah, that's not what it says. Yeah,
I was looking for the Murray Mikra of something, you know, you studied your whole life, preacher, you know, it never occurred to you that...
How in the world can you claim to be a professional religious doofus quoting out of the Greek New Testament, and the single most important word for you is church, and you haven't figured out that ecclesia doesn't mean church?
No, that's because seminary schools do the same thing that public education does today. They don't teach you how to think. They teach you what to think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what every single pastor has went through, is seminary that has taught them what to think, not how to think.
Yeah. And they just steal each other's sermons.
Oh, my God. But that is so unbelievably stupid.
Yeah.
Now, I understand if you're like the carpet layers that I had here with the son was, you can't take my church away from me. You know, Jesus said, upon this rock, I will build my church. No, he didn't. He didn't speak English. He didn't even speak Greek. He spoke Hebrew, and let me tell you what he actually said. And this is what it means. You have been lied to. And what you choose to do is believe those who have lied to you. Shame on you. That's why God finds all of them disgusting. The lie is so obvious, you know. Alan has created a Amazon instant print of the book, so you can get them from Clariton, the fast order printer, which we've had them for quite some time, or you can buy the books now from Amazon. And so Questioning Paul and An Introduction to God and all the volumes of Yada Yada are available in a little bit more manageable size, at least a 6x9 size of these books. And so I ordered a set of them, and they came in 2 days. It was really fast. And
Amazon is awesome for that.
Amazon's are really cheap. I mean, for example, every volume of, I think it's, you know, the 7 volumes of Yada Yada plus Introduction to God plus Questioning Paul is just a shade over $100.
That's not bad.
Oh, yeah.
I already got the big versions, or else I'd order some.
Yeah. I bought
Kindle
a
version, too. I love Kindle versions.
Yeah,
I'm glad he did that work, too, because those are nice to have for a quick reference.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, I opened Questioning Paul, and I'm reading this, and it's just it constantly says, this is how I was fooled. But once you know the truth, it is so damn obvious. All you do is you're going to kick yourself up one side and down the other, because it is so obvious that Paul lied.
Yeah.
And, you know, where God is saying that there are three types of people in the world in the end, and the vast preponderance are either deceivers, deceived, with a very small number of members of his family, God doesn't have any compassion for those who have been deceived.
No.
He, of course, despises, hates the deceivers, and hell is awaiting them. By the way, there's an interesting bit on that. It talks about Sheol is celebrating. It's quivering in excitement, inviting in anticipation of your arrival. And this is Yada Yada 14. And the moods and the description are wholly and completely personified. And so under that basis, is talking about the adversary, Hillel ben Shakar, Satan. Is it Paul that's quivering with excitement? Shaul? To have at the arrival of Hasatan? Because the place, how does the place quiver with anticipation?
Yeah.
It's really interesting that the whole description.
When you consider the link between Sheol and Shaul.
Right.
Same word.
Kind of gives you a little clue right there.
Yeah, so it's really, the whole thing is really interesting, but it is so obvious.
But I'll tell you, the reason there's no reason to have pity or really feel guilty about the people who have been deceived is we live in a world where it's not like the Dark Ages where people were deceived because the knowledge wasn't there and they had no access to it. Those people you can feel sorry for. In today's day and age, with knowledge at your fingertips the way it is, I don't feel bad for anyone who has been deceived because they have it right there. Any one of them can get on the internet and do the research for themselves and come to these kind of conclusions that we have.
Mm-hmm.
They choose not to. That is their own fault.
That's why that was the point I was trying to make is that it's the truth is so easily found and the lies are so easily uncovered that God doesn't have any compassion for the billions who are deceived. It's your own damn fault. If you're a Christian, shame on you. If you're a Muslim, you are too stupid for words. Wake up. And the New Testament is obviously a pack of lies. The Quran is the worst book ever written. The Talmud are stupid arguments. And the basis of the Talmud that you can't understand the Torah because obviously God was not a very good communicator. So you need us rabbis to argue about it.
Men are obviously much better at communication than God. We have a great
history. But I, Paul, say. Yes, exactly. So what happens then after the end of this presentation of Babel? We read the following. And Terach lived 70 years, and he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And so this is the perspective of the account of Terach. Terach fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Then Haran followed Lot, fathered Lot. And Haran died in the presence of Terah, his father, in the land of his relatives' customs, in Ur of the Casdim. Casdim are the Babylonians. So he grasped hold and took Abram and Nahor along with their wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and the father of Ekah. But then Sarai was infertile, for she was without child. Terah grasped hold and took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, and the wife of his son Abram. And they came out from Ur of the Casdim of the Babylonians to walk to the land of Canaan, the Canaanites. But they only came as far as Charan and settled there. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Charan. That's a Bereshit 11, about 28 to 32. So here it is we dig down and develop each statement. So, and Terah. Terah means the living embodiment of the two messages of Teruah, of proclaiming the joyous news of God's beneficial healing while rebuking man's fraudulent treachery and deceit. That's an interesting name. Lived, stayed alive, 70, which means satisfying promises of 7 years, times of renewal. And he fathered, Yalad, impregnated his wife to conceive the descendants, Abram, father who lifts up, father who increases, rises and grows, father who enhances the capability and status, providing added aptitude, competency, and proficiency. Nahor, which means one who snores. That's funny. And Haran, the high and mighty whose fortress is overthrown, pulled down, and destroyed. So these are interesting names. And so this is the perspective of the account. This is the written genealogical record regarding the descendants, the history, and the result of Terah, the living embodiment of the two messages of Teruah. Terah fathered, conceived the descendants, Abraham, father who lifts up, Nahor, one who snores, and Haran, high and mighty, who is pulled down. You know, it's interesting in this regard that Abraham is the one of the few, that's the covenant member, one who rises, one who grows, one who lives up. So you got the covenant. Nahor is like the vast preponderance of people. They're comatose. They just snore through everything. They haven't figured it out. They're not going to figure it out.
The way
of a life, right? You're right. And then Haran is the high and mighty. So you got the those who mislead.
Where did he go?
Those are, he
went back.
Not so good. Yeah, he went back. Yeah. So those collectively, they represent the three classes of people that exist at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really does.
Yep, and Haran fathered Lot, one who is shrouded, blocking any association with the light. You know, I want to tell you that, you know, Christians want to pretend that Lot represents the rapture. And Lot's an idiot.
Yeah,
I'm not even sure he's a useful idiot. Yeah. He was Abraham's nephew, and God honors family ties. And so Abraham was God's adopted son. And because of the family ties, when Abraham asked him, would you spare the place if there were, because God keeps on going down, he says, if I can find one decent person down there, I'll spare that individual. Turned out to be Lot. And Lot was the best of a bad lot for darn sure. But yeah, his wife was an idiot. His daughters were immoral. Yeah, this is Lot was at best a useful idiot.
Yeah.
So then Haran, the high and mighty, whose fortress is overthrown, in the presence, or perished, I should say, he perished. He died a mortal death in the presence of Tirach, his father. In the country of his relatives, and with whom he identified politically and religiously, he never got out of Dodge. He just died right there. He died among them. If you don't walk away from religion and politics, then you have no chance of forming a relationship with God. This fellow
then
never got away from it. Pardon?
Don't first have it. This is a non.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, it's a no-go. You either come walk away, or we ain't talking.
Right. He didn't. Haran died because,
he didn't
walk away.
Yeah.
So he died in the country of his with his relatives, with whom he identified politically and religiously. And that was the mightiest city of the age. Of the Kashtan, of the Babylonians, of the religious sages and astrologers. It's transliterated Chaldeans, which is a synonym from Babylon, from Kashtan. Intellectuals and statesmen, religious prophets and fortune tellers, priests and magicians, all the things God hates. And Kashtan, to be lame and crippled, means stubborn and headstrong. And Kashal, to stagger and stumble as a result of being self-willed. Now, for anyone that's questioning, why in the world did we transit? I explained why we told the story of Babel, not once but twice. If you don't understand Babel, you're never going to appreciate where we're going. And where we're going is we're following Yashaya through his prophetic witness. And if you don't understand Babel, you aren't going to understand where Yahweh is taking us through the prophet Yashaya.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason that we're going back now and picking up the story of with Abraham here in Observations with Our Time is because if you don't come to understand the covenant and how it came to be formed with Abraham and what the conditions are, you aren't going with us. You know, you're going to be just like poor old Haran here. You're going to die left behind. So we're going to spend what is really two chapters of time simply trying to understand everything that can be known about the covenant. Because if you aren't part of the covenant, you aren't coming with us. Doesn't matter even what you understand. You are being left behind. So he grasped hold of and took Abram and Nahor, one who snores, along with their wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, noble woman, wife with status, leader, branch, official offshoot from Sarah, to contend and strive with, to engage and endure with, to struggle and wrestle with, to be empowered and to persist with. Sarah was named Sarah because of the extraordinary importance of that name, because it became the basis of Yish Sarah El, individuals who engage and endure with God. But it also, because of the name Sarah, also shows the side of struggle and wrestle with. It gives us an accurate depiction of Yisrael with and estranged from God. So it is a comprehensive picture. That's why her name was as it was, Sarai. It also means to persevere, to be have a royal birth, which we do as part of the covenant, and to be empowered, and to be a liberator. We're liberated in the covenant. And the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. Milcah means queen, the daughter of Haran. Boy, there's a lot of incestuous kinds of things going along here, isn't it? This was a family that was very closely related. The father of Milcah and the father of Yitzchak, the observant. So then Sarai, the noble woman and wife with status from Sarah to contend and strive with, engage and endure with, to be empowered by and to liberate, was infertile, sterile and barren, unable to conceive, as from a car to be uprooted, to have one's roots cut and to be plucked up. So roots are a metaphor for offspring. For she was without child. Well, that's because she was going to become the mother of the covenant. Terach, the embodiment of Teruah, proclaiming the joyous news of God's beneficial healing, while rebuking man's fraudulent treachery and deceit, grasped hold of and took Abram and his son Lot and the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, the wife of his son Abram. But God really goes to quite some extent to say, here's how the players are related. You know, I want you to know who Lot is in relationship to Abram. I want you to know who Sarah is in relationship to every one of the players. It was important for God to for him to present the family ties here.
I think that's pretty good communication, Rabbi. To the rabbi who says, you know, he doesn't talk, you have to have me. That's pretty plain.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, one of the things that I like here is that there are times in this where God is presenting sophisticated thoughts, where if you dig really deep, you turn over every stone, you learn, like, these are the three different classes of people that live in the world today. That's a fairly sophisticated insight. And there's other places where, okay, I'm going to repeat this again. This is the relationship to one another. All right? So it's both simple and deep. And they came out with him from Ur of the Casdim Babylonians, the land of fortune tellers, astrologers, magicians, and the intellectuals, if you will, to walk to the land of Canaan, of the lowly and the subdued, from Cana, to be brought down because of a pretentious attitude, and Canaan, to subjugate others as merchants and traders who barter. But they only came as far as Charan, diseased by the sun, to taunt and jeopardize through blaspheme, and they settled there. So the good news here is that at this point, has God had a conversation with or introduced himself to Abram?
No.
He hasn't. Hadn't talked to anybody. So until they got well out of Babylon, God didn't even bother to introduce himself to them. So they've made it now two-thirds of the way. And while they're still going to head to the land of Canaan, that was their intent, it's not going to be to hang with the Canaanites. That's important if you want to understand how the covenant works. So the days of Terach, the embodiment of Teruah, were 205 years. And Terach died in Charan. You know, the first condition of the covenant is not only to walk away from your country, which would be Babylon in their case, but to walk away from your father's house. Now, in this case, the father went all the way to Charan. But for God, who has not yet met with or introduced himself to Abram, to do so and to invite him to be part of the covenant, he needs to walk away from his country, which he's done, his father's house, which now he's prepared to do, and also from the societal customs, which he is also prepared to do. So Terach died there in Charan, diseased by the sun. This then takes us to the introduction, which is exactly what you would expect. Now Yahweh said to Abram. Not before. He did not speak to Abram while he was in Ur. He didn't speak to Abram while he was a Babylonian. Didn't speak to Abram while he was just a few steps away from the place. Didn't speak to Abram while he was still in his father's house. Now, explaining that this is the prerequisite for engaging in a relationship with God. Now, Yahweh said to Abram. Now, at this point, does Abram know Yahweh?
No, not at all.
No. Does Abram know any one of the conditions of the covenant?
He's been approached by him, but that's it.
Right. Does he know any part of the Torah?
Well, he knows the first condition. He had to walk away from his people and his place.
Yeah, he has done that. I'm not sure he's put two and two. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he's put two and two
together. Well, he knows Yahweh wasn't going to engage with him until he had done that.
But
so.
He didn't even know who Yahweh is.
He didn't know who Yahweh was.
Yeah.
So
that's,
it's going to be Yahweh. The reason it's presented this way, JB, is the same way that it worked with me. And I think this is the way God works with a lot of people, is that I did not know God when he first approached me, but I had left Christianity. I was no longer political. I had met too many powerful political people. I was just disgusted by them. And so I wasn't religious anymore. I wasn't political anymore. That's when God introduced himself. I didn't know who he was. I knew he was God, but I had no idea who God was. I didn't know the Torah. I didn't know the terms and conditions of the covenant. It's at that point that he makes the introduction, and then it is your responsibility or your option to either come to know him and become part of the covenant as he's laid it out, or not. But he'll do the introduction, and then it's your opportunity to choose what you're going to do. And so Yahweh made the introduction. So he spoke to Abram, and he says, "It is for you of your own free will to approach by walking away from halak la ata mem." For you to actually, literally, and genuinely choose to approach and draw near by you electing to travel, journey, and go away, distancing yourself from you, living by means of following and by way of separating yourself from. This was written in the call imperative, speaking of a relationship which is straightforward and based upon free will. Your country, Eretz Ata, your state and world, where you were established in the material realm, your land and territory, the place where your people exist, and away from your society, culture, and community. Moledat, your relatives and relationships, the people with whom you identify and their customs. Circumcising yourself from your origins and kindred souls, your people and place of your nativity. From Mul, Ed, and Yalad, to ward off and separate oneself from opposing oaths which eternally cut off and separate children who are born blemished and in pain. So the first thing, walk away from your country. The second, walk away distancing yourself from your society, culture, and community. And third, and also from your father's household. Your father's home, dwelling, place, lineage, and possession. You can be, to be a child of God, you have to cease being a descendant of man.
Mm-hmm.
To be in God's family, you have to leave man's family.
Yeah.
To be in God's community, you need to distance yourself from the community of man. To rely and depend upon God and to walk with him, you need to walk away from one's country, depending on one's country, from relying on one's country, from oaths of alliance with one's country, and also from your father's household, to the land, to the realm and place, which bestows the blessings of the relationship, Asher, which provides the benefits of an upright, fortuitous, an elevated state, a joyful and happy attitude, and an encouraged and content mindset to those walking the correct way along the proper and specific path to a prosperous life. Stepping out with regard to this teaching and guidance to pursue life the right way. A lot of words to properly explain Asher, which I will show you. Ra'ah, which I will reveal and make known to you. It is a extraordinary statement, isn't it? That's the first statement. You know, Yahweh said to Abram, "Here, I want you to walk away from your country, from your culture and society, and from your father's household, from the house of man, to the realm which bestows the blessing of the relationship, which I will show you."
That's everything he knows.
Wow.
That's why it's so hard, initially.
Yeah.
You walk away from everything. You know,
correct.
You want to tug along something with you, and you can't, and it's bad enough, you took a lot. But
right.
He drug him out, and Yahweh didn't want him. I think people
right.
did. Yahweh didn't ask him to take a lot. In fact, he didn't even like him to take a lot, but he said, okay.
Right. Correct. So that's that is the lone prerequisite. The first thing that Yahweh says to Abraham, I don't know how you people miss that when they, the Christians wouldn't think they have a renewed covenant. No, you don't even have a covenant because the first requirement of the covenant, you can't be
away from your religion.
Right. You can't be political. You can't be patriotic.
You
can't be a statesman.
Take the Christmas tree with you. Sorry.
Right. Yeah, the societal custom of the Christmas tree, of Easter, of Halloween. You can't have that stuff if you're going to live with me. You're not bringing that crap into my home. So all of those, you know, 4th of July and Halloween and Happy New Year and Christmas and Easter and the Flag Day and Memorial Day and Labor Day. You
Veterans Day.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Lord's Day being Sunday, you have to distance yourself from that. You have to separate yourself from that, or you're not desirable in my home. I'm not going to have you in my home. And if you're going to be pro-country, patriotic, and a statesman, and engaged in politics, you are not welcome in my family.
Yeah.
And if you want to be part of the family of man, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. You're just not going to become part of my covenant family. Pretty amazing. That's the first statement, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, guys, we had
a rough
start.
Too.
It's fair. It's reasonable. It's fair. It establishes the covenant like Eden. None of those things were in Eden. And that's what God views as ideal. That's where he's taking us back to. That's what he created initially. God's no smarter now than he was when he created Eden. He thought Eden was perfect. So he's taking us right back there. That's what we're going back to. He's going to replicate Eden, and none of these things were in Eden, and therefore he says, distance yourself from them. But that's the first statement he makes. It wasn't, hey, hello, Abram. You're probably wondering why it is that I'm introducing myself to you. Hi, Abram. You know, I'm God. Let me do some magic tricks for you to prove it.
Let me report
Abram,
signs
here's
and wonders.
Did you read it? Yeah. Hi, Abram. I'm the antithesis of Bel Marduk, or Sin. Sin was actually the chief god at the time of Ur. Hello, Abram. I'm going to show off here for you. Let me impress you here some. No. Or, hello, Abram. First thing you need to do is lift me up in prayer. First thing you need to do, Abram, I'm
bow down and pray.
Bow down.
Get on your knees.
Yeah. Hello, Abram. I'm worship me. Didn't say worship me, didn't say bow down to me, didn't say join the church. He
saved.
Yeah, didn't have anything powerful or fancy. It's kind of like the first time he introduced himself to me. I have a job I'd like you to do. Will you do this job for me? Or with me? It's just so insightful when you think it through. So here's the first requirement, the prerequisite of the covenant, and here's how God introduced himself to Abram. He wasn't showing off. No fancy signs, no miracles, no proof. The proof would be in, as we get to know each other, I'm going to share some things with you, and they're going to blow your mind. But, you know, it's first, are you just willing to follow him when he introduces himself? Are you willing to go where his words lead? Are you willing to trust him? You want to get to know him? It is for you, of your own free will, to approach. And you don't approach by worshiping him. You don't approach by praising him. You don't approach by bowing down to him. You don't approach by praying to him. None of those things were there. You approach by walking away. Right? You approach by walking away.
From walking away from man, when he is walking to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, is it possible to give up and walk away from man's ways?
Yeah, you'd be a hermit. I guess not.
Yeah, a hermit, a reckless. Yeah. There are people that do that. The next step is, you know, to walk to me and become perfect, so that we are going to get there on the next step. But it doesn't start on this one. But that is just so profound. It's a good place for us to stop this evening. I'm sorry we had so much problem, JB. I am so glad that you stuck with it. Thank you for getting us all live and together.
Thank you,
JB. Awfully glad we have the chat room. I would not have known that we were recording and broadcasting had it not been for the chat room. It'll be interesting to see if there's an archive. I hope there is.
I think it was going out. We've had enough participation in the chat room. I think people were able to hear it. I'm obviously able to hear it, so I think it's being recorded. So find out tomorrow when I go to download it to put it up on the web. So,
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well,
I'm not going to be here next week. I got some family in town, and they're wanting to take me out for my birthday next Friday, so I will be away, but I'll be back the week after that.
Okay. Fair enough. Thank you, guys.
Yes, sir.
Take care.
Enjoy.
All right. Good night.
Shabbat shalom to both of you.
Yes, shabbat shalom. Good night.
Shalom.